Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working on this pre-recorded program via remote. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan this Thursday, December 9, 2021. A UK-based watchdog accuses the South Sudan People's Defense Forces and the SPLM in opposition of committing serious atrocities in Western Equatoria State.
Local groups affiliated to the South Sudanese Army or aligned with the South Sudanese Army on one hand and the armed opposition on the other, had waged what was essentially a campaign of terror.
And the U.S. donates thousands of doses of Johnson & Johnson vaccine to fight COVID-19 in South Sudan.
The United States government stands in solidarity with the people of South Sudan. We want to make sure that we have an equitable distribution of vaccines to people who need it.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Amnesty International says humanitarian needs are massive in Western Equatoria after dozens of people were killed and at least 80,000 others were displaced from their homes in Tombora County. Roya Ragi is a senior crisis advisor with Amnesty International. She tells Nabil Biagio that South Sudan People's Defense Forces and the SPLA in opposition forces encourage ethnic tensions between two communities in Tombora. She says the two armies are responsible for human rights violations against civilians in Western Equatoria State.
What we found or what we documented is that between June and October of this year, local groups affiliated to the South Sudanese Army or aligned with the South Sudanese Army on one hand and the armed opposition on the other, had waged what was essentially a campaign of terror upon the civilian population, namely the Balanda and Azande communities in Tombora County in Western Equatoria State. According to our findings, this fighting was much more than intercommunal violence. So while politicians did whip up ethnic hatred and mobilized local youth to fight, and essentially the attacks involved local groups, but these local groups were also primarily affiliated or aligned with government and opposition forces.
You speak of violence whose scale and nature goes beyond intercommunal violence, which we see a lot of in South Sudan and which is often driven by competition over resources. Tell our listeners a little bit of the background here. What caused all of this? Where did it start?
To the best of our knowledge, the recent violence in Western Equatoria State can be traced to the allocation of the state to the SPLM in opposition in May of 2020. This had come as part of a power-sharing agreement between parties to the 2018 peace deal. And so at the time of the allocation, shortly after the allocation of the state to the SPLM-IO, the first vice president, Riek Machar, subsequently appointed a governor, and it appears that that appointment had angered key figures in the political elite among the Azande community, who had historically governed Western Equatoria State. We consider that the fighting is part of the ongoing armed conflict in South Sudan, because while, yes, it did involve local armed groups, they were aligned with the military on the one hand and the armed opposition forces on the other. The violence is essentially connected to competition over power sharing agreements and contextually can be considered as an extension of the conflict that erupted in December 2013. They are not considered isolated acts of violence and they must be viewed within the context of the wider conflict.
Your report says dozens of people were killed and more than 80,000 displaced from their homes and atrocities were committed, even potential war crimes. Tell us what you were able to verify of these allegations?
So we spoke to 50 survivors, many of whom had witnessed firsthand a variety of human rights and international humanitarian law violations. Survivors told us of harrowing accounts of escaping indiscriminate gunfire that lasted for hours, and of entire neighborhoods being set alight. Many spoke of seeing their relatives or neighbors shot to death, fighters slitting people's throats. We also documented incidents where stray bullets landed in homes or IDP shelters, injuring civilians, including particularly a case of a 10-year-old girl who we documented her case. Hunger and inadequate shelter had also forced civilians out of their hiding place after they had run out. And even when they were coming out from hiding, they were still being captured and faced their death at the hands of fighters. One thing that really came across through our interviews was just the extent of the horrors that civilians witnessed. Bodies were set on fire and mutilated or left to decompose for days without proper burial. Most of the people we interviewed also told us that their homes were looted or burned, that their crops were left unharvested. And satellite imagery did verify the extent of the widespread damage or destruction to the houses, as civilians had told us that had taken place between June and October across Sembora County. One thing to really note is the extent of the humanitarian crisis that is taking place at the moment across Sembora County. We're talking about 80,000 people who have been displaced. The vast majority of people we spoke to complained about their shelter conditions, whether they are in IDP camps or are living in host communities. Many of them spoke of extreme hunger, of their kids being out of school, of not being able to afford medication, let alone, of course, describing the horrific and traumatic exposures that they've been exposed to, and their desperate need for humanitarian assistance, including psychosocial care.
Have you been in touch with the South Sudan People's Defense Forces and the SPLA-IO regarding this report? And what recommendations do you have?
We did, as Amnesty International, meet and speak with some government officials, as well as members of affiliated to the SPLM-IO. Questions were posed to the South Sudan People's Defense Forces, but they went unanswered. What we are recommending is a series of steps. First of all, really, in order to address the humanitarian crisis, there needs to be a massive ramping up of humanitarian assistance to the displaced people. The government must absolutely facilitate that assistance, and humanitarian agencies should really consider increasing the assistance to the displaced population. The government must expedite the reconstruction efforts and ensure a safe and voluntary return. Absolutely has to be voluntary, of civilians should they feel that they are comfortable enough to return to their homes and to their towns. But of course, that is contingent on these reconstruction efforts, because many civilians told us that while in theory they would like to go back home, what would they be going back to with the mass destruction that had taken place? And of course, they do have still lingering security concerns because of the lingering presence of some fighters and of some of the politicians that were implicated in the violence. So reconstruction efforts and security efforts go hand in hand with the call for that safe and voluntary return. The government must also ensure that those who are responsible for the potential war crimes that we documented and the other violations that we documented are held to account.
That's Roya Raghi, Senior Crisis Advisor at Amnesty International. She spoke with my colleague Nabil Biagio from New York. Clashes between farmers, rangers, and fishers over water scarcity have escalated along Cameroon's northern border with Chad. Cameroonian officials say villages and markets were torched Wednesday, and violent conflict sent thousands fleeing into neighboring Chad. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports for VOA from Yaoundé.
A messenger sent by traditional rulers tells at least 120 people in Kuseri, a town in Cameroon's northern border with Chad, that without peace, there will be no development and communities will become poorer. He says armed conflicts will only bring hunger and suffering. The message is broadcast several times on Cameroon's CRTV, a government-controlled radio and TV station in Masa, Musgum, and Arab Shua languages. Masa, Musgum, and Arab Shua communities live in the Logon and Shari division where Kuseri is located. Government officials in Logon and Shari said they initiated the message of peace after a conflict among farmers, cattle ranchers, and fishers over water degenerated into a violent conflict Wednesday in the communities. On Wednesday night, community leaders said several villages were torched, farms destroyed, and parts of the largest market in Kuseri set on fire. They said more than 40 people have been killed, 70 wounded, and several thousand civilians have crossed over to Chad for safety. Mahamat Abba is the Sultan, a traditional ruler of Kuseri.
Je voudrais rappeler à toute la population.
Abba says, as the leader of Kuseri, he is reminding people of all communities in the commercial town that they must seek peace, unity, and solidarity as long as they live together. He says he is reminding his Musgum, Arab Shua, and Masa brothers and sisters that peace is priceless. He says a town or community cannot develop when there is war or an armed conflict. Abba spoke to VOA via the messaging app WhatsApp from Kuseri. Earlier this week, Cameroon's authorities said clashes erupted between ranchers and fishers over water in Logon and Shari. Arab Shua cattle ranchers accused Musgum fishers of digging holes that have resulted in deaths of their cows, sheep, and donkeys. The Musgum fishers dig the holes to conserve water and lure their catch. Musgum fishermen also accuse Arab Shua cattle ranchers of allowing their cattle to destroy areas reserved only for fishing. The government says when fighting erupted again, Masa farmers also accused Arab Shua cattle ranchers of allowing their cattle to destroy plantations. Masa farmers joined Musgum fishermen to attack Arab Shua cattle ranchers. Arab Shua have been fighting back. Mijiyawa Bakari is the governor of Cameroon's far north region where Logon and Shari is located. He says he led a delegation of senior state officials and a military sent by Cameroonian President Paul Biya to Logon and Shari on Wednesday night. He says Biya asked the delegation to ensure a return to peace among Masa, Musgum, and Arab Shua communities that are fighting, killing each other, and destroying property. Bakari spoke via the messaging app WhatsApp from Kuseri.
Il nous a été instruit de leur dire de travailler en synergie.
Bakari says Biya wants the rival communities to bury their differences and immediately drop their weapons for the sake of peace. Bakari says the conflict may discourage many soccer fans from neighboring Chad, Sudan, Niger, and Libya, who will be traveling to Cameroon through Logon and Shari for the African Football Cup of Nations that begins on January 9. He says Cameroon cannot afford to tarnish its image at the time when the African continent's attention is focused on the Central African state for AFCON. Bakari said Cameroonians must learn to live together and communities must respect and cherish their linguistic, cultural, and religious differences. Cameroon says desertification is also pushing farmers, fishermen, and cattle ranchers to move to places where they can find food and water. Many farmers, cattle ranchers, and fishermen settle along the Logon River in the Logon and Shari division for survival leading to regular conflicts. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudan receives another shipment of Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine. That story is lined up after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
does your family often get together to celebrate holidays?
My family is low income and they don't have much for holidays because it requires a lot of money, maybe a lot of traveling.
It is occasion actually, maybe end of year or these other celebrations like for different religions like Christmas, Eid. Those are some of the occasions we normally come together as a family.
For me, my family, well, they are not together. They are all scattered in different countries, so getting together is a bit difficult.
Family often get together to celebrate, not even on holidays, but ordinary days, especially on Sundays.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. South Sudan today received second batch of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine donated by the Biden administration. A program director at the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, in Juba says hundreds of thousands of doses of the vaccine have been donated to help South Sudanese fight the pandemic. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Diana Davis, program director at USAID, says 168,000 doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine were delivered to South Sudan as part of the U.S. government's global efforts to fight the coronavirus.
The U.S. government is providing a lot of vaccines all over the world and is partnering with many, many countries and other organizations worldwide and on the ground to make sure that more people have access to vaccines so we can finally defeat this pandemic.
It's the second batch of Johnson & Johnson vaccine sent by the U.S. to South Sudan. The first batch of 152,000 doses was donated in September. The U.S. plans to donate 1.2 billion COVID-19 vaccine doses globally to help end the pandemic. Davis says later this month, the U.S. will donate another 336,000 doses of Johnson & Johnson vaccine to South Sudan.
The United States government stands in solidarity with the people of South Sudan. We want to make sure that we have an equitable distribution of vaccines to people who need it, because our world is interconnected. It's going to be very critical that we work together and make sure that the global response continues so we can fight the pandemic and make sure we succeed.
Dr. Brendan Dinin, the COVAX coordinator for the World Health Organization in South Sudan, tells South Sudan in Focus the arrival of the Johnson & Johnson doses will boost the efforts by the South Sudan government and its partner agencies to fight the pandemic nationwide. Dinin says the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has been delivered to many rural areas in the country. He says 90% of the 152,000 vaccine doses delivered in September have already been used. Dinin is urging South Sudanese to get vaccinated and practice preventive measures like wearing face masks, washing hands, and social distancing. He says local transmission of the virus is still active across South Sudan and notes cases are rising in parts of the world where many people are not vaccinated.
The areas in the world that have had low uptake have seen continued severe disease, hospitalizations, people in intensive care units, and the like. So one key element is to increase the percentage of adults who are to be vaccinated here in the country, and that can only be done through deployment of vaccines that come, like today.
Dinan says the emergency of the new Omicron variant requires stepped-up preventive efforts against the pandemic.
This variant of concern that was first reported in South Africa has now been reported in Uganda, and this is a very highly transmissible variant of the standard coronavirus that we have seen over the last 2 years spread throughout the world. Now we have even more reason to vaccinate people. It has always been there, but it is most important because of the high transmissibility of the Omicron variant.
South Sudan continues to register more active cases of the coronavirus. As of Wednesday, the Ministry of Health registered 6 new cases. Since the outbreak of the virus last year in South Sudan, the Ministry of Health has registered a total of 12,842 positive cases and 133 deaths. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Still on COVID, the World Health Organization says convalescent plasma does not prevent people from dying from COVID-19 and advises against its use. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Various studies over time have been conducted to see whether convalescent plasma, that is, the transfusion of blood plasma from someone who has recovered from COVID-19, can save the lives of people newly infected with the deadly disease. The head of the World Health Organization's Clinical Care Emergencies Program, Janet Diaz, says some of these studies have shown different results in the efficacy of this treatment.
But when we look at the totality of the evidence, so not just individual trials, but bring it all together, the certainty in the non-severe patients, so those mild patients, is pretty high to moderate that it does not have an important impact on mortality.
Diaz says clinical experts in different fields of medicine have issued new guidelines on the use of convalescent plasma. She says they are based on evidence gathered from 16 clinical trials involving more than 16,000 patients with non-severe, severe, and critical COVID-19 infections. As such, she says WHO strongly recommends against the use of convalescent plasma for the treatment of non-severe COVID-19. Current high certainty evidence, she says, shows it does not result in an important reduction in mortality.
The second recommendation is a recommendation against the use of convalescent plasma in patients with severe and critical COVID-19 outside of clinical trials. This is based on low certainty evidence that convalescent plasma may have little or no impact on mortality.
Diaz notes uncertainty remains about the potential benefits of convalescent plasma among people who are critically ill with COVID-19. Therefore, she says, the panel of experts thinks it's important to continue clinical trials in the use of this treatment for this category of patients. Such carefully monitored, ethically structured trials, she adds, would help generate more evidence on the actual effects of this treatment among severely ill patients. In February, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration scaled back its convalescent plasma emergency use authorization based on the results of clinical trials. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Living through a pandemic has been a stressful and difficult challenge. Divisions between vaccinated and unvaccinated have made the past year even more stressful. Karina Bafredizian reports on both sides and efforts to change minds.
Sometime over the past 2 years, getting a COVID vaccine became a huge point of conflict between Americans. There are websites devoted to shaming people who refuse the vaccine, only to become seriously ill or die from the disease. And there have been reported threats of violence leveled against vaccine advocates and public health experts like Dr. Anthony Fauci. Digging past politics, the fact remains that COVID hits the unvaccinated the hardest, but that fact doesn't seem to be registering. Pier Carlo Valdesolo is an associate professor of psychology at Claremont McKenna College.
What we're seeing with the virus is a highly politicized topic, stoking in-group, out-group sentiments. And one of the dominant ways that people react emotionally to the suffering of out-group members is a muted sense of empathy, and at the extreme, even a sense of pleasure in the pain of out-group members.
Retired Maryland resident Linda Mercer was initially against getting a COVID-19 vaccine. She says her concern rose from the speed with which the vaccine was developed, and relatives and former colleagues shared her skepticism. But that changed in the middle of 2021, when Mercer got the virus. Mercer spent a few weeks in hospital. After she recovered, she and her family got the vaccine.
It made me say, okay, get the vaccine, because if the vaccine could just save you from getting as sick as I did, I'd rather have the vaccine than to catch COVID again.
Experts say Mercer's story shows how vaccine opponents can change the minds of others with similar views.
At least from a psychological perspective, it makes sense that anti-vaxxers would be more compelled by the story of an individual in-group member who is suffering than reading news stories about how many people are dying of COVID every day or how effective a vaccine is.
A study at Brigham Young University suggests that personal stories do more to encourage vaccinations than faceless statistics. In an experiment, students who opposed the vaccine interviewed people who got illnesses that could have been prevented with a vaccine. By the end, roughly 70% of students had changed their mind about vaccinations. Experts say this suggests that education does more to change attitudes about vaccines than does public shaming. For Karina Bafrajan in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
That's all we prepared for you this Thursday. We now leave you with some Lokoya traditional song from Eastern Equatorial State.
Kaila kaila bene ya ekele mena madara na ditaga.
We've been listening to a traditional song by the Lokoya group in Eastern Equatorial State. I'm John Tanza. Thanks for allowing us into your homes, phones, and vehicles. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from getting COVID-19. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Madara na de jaga.